So let's get started. If you have any questions, send it in. We'll try our hardest to answer that after the service. I just want to start off with just even considering just how the sound system's gone this morning. I think a lot of us plan how we want our lives to go, but we often confront a reality that it's not as we had hoped or what we have seen. So I want to acknowledge something this morning. I know that some of us here this morning are doing it tough. I know for some of us, we found the Christian life or the Christian walk following Jesus more complicated than you imagined. Your life isn't what you expected, whether it's your job, your family, your friends, your social circles, or whatever. There are things in your life that have made this whole experience just hard, have almost wanting to draw you away from God rather than closer to Him. And I just want to acknowledge that. I think there's an illusion that when I come up here at the front, that somehow I will read God's word, I will try my hardest to preach it faithfully, and for me it's just smooth sailing, which is not the case. I have just as many lows as I have highs, and I equally find the Christian walk difficult at times, where I've got nothing left but Christ and Him alone. So my hope this morning is that these passages would refresh you, would encourage you, would remind you to cling to Christ, to rest in Him, and that following Him is not just about the strength that you muster in your life, but it is about the strength of the one we trust in. And I pray that if you're a visitor this morning trying to work out what the whole Christian thing is, I pray that you would be invited to something that is so supremely precious that it would make your heart sing. So on that note, let me pray. Dear Father, you are in control of all things. Last week we saw that as your Son spoke to the winds and waves, it obeyed and it was silent. Your word is mighty and powerful. And Father, it seems so often that in all creation, we as human beings made in your image are often the only creatures in all creation that just don't want to listen, don't want to hear, don't want to see. But Father, I ask that you'd be gracious and merciful this morning and that you would help us to hear and that you would help us to see. And that, Father, through that hearing and seeing of your word, you would transform us. That is simply what I ask, and it's simply what we all desire. And I pray all this in your Son's most precious and most beautiful name. Amen. Look, I'm just going to go straight into it. Look, Jesus, last week we heard, after commanding the winds and waves to be still, left those who were in the boat with Jesus to ask the question, who is he? And we sort of left it at that. We now reach the other side of where that boat was going into a region called Gerasenes, across the other side of the Sea of Galilee. So if you see Galilee, they've crossed. They don't know exactly where that region is, so it's roughly around there. And it's intentional what Jesus is about to do, in not only doing what he did in the sea, but crossing to this region that is predominantly a Gentile region. In other words, the people that lived there weren't Jewish, and this is an incredibly important marker to sort of think through. The question that the disciples sort of asked, who is this man that can command the winds and waves, is almost about to be answered by a live parable. So what's about to happen is, if you like to think of it, is a live parable. And I'll explain it as we go through. But please join with me at Mark chapter 5, verse 1. They came to the other side of the sea, to the region of the Gerasenes. As soon as he got out of the boat, a man with an unclean spirit came out of the tombs and met him. He lived in the tombs, and no one was able to restrain him anymore, not even with a chain, because he often had been bound with shackles and chains, but had torn the chains apart and smashed the shackles. No one was strong enough to subdue him. Night and day, among the tombs and on the mountains, he was always crying out and cutting himself with stones. To say that Jesus attracted all manner of people would be an understatement. But for a moment, I need us to grasp what's going on here. That who comes to meet Jesus is incredibly important. It is a man with an unclean spirit, which may sound weird to a lot of us, considering also that he's met a lot of these people so far already. But what I want you to notice is the detail surrounding this bloke. He lived in the tombs. In other words, his home was the local graveyard. His company, if you like, were the dead, bones, dirt. His only community, the people that he was part of, had ostracized him, had forsaken him to a place of the dead because they could not help him, or, if you like, their solution to restrain and subdue. In other words, they couldn't control the bloke. So what do you do? What do humans do when we can't control the situation? We do what every loving human does. We get rid of it. We ostracize it. We try to control it. And when we can't, we get rid of it. So as we think about that for a moment, this bloke is living with the dead. He's cast out. Those who know him best want nothing to do with him, would rather him be dead. The only reason they probably haven't killed him is that he's strong enough to break chains. And there he is. As he sees Jesus come to the shore, he rushes to him. He was dead in every way but the physical sense. He was so broken, so full of hopelessness, so full of hurt and pain that he spent his living moments, and you have to grasp this, his living moments crying out, shouting, it says in the Greek, a piercing cry of agony and despair. Who can help me? Is how he spent most of his day. Imagine that, the emotional, mental strain to have your whole life be one of just crying out, but finding no respite, no relief, no hope, no hope. Imagine cutting yourself as the relief to trying to deal with your current state of things. Almost as though it was better to cut yourself in order to feel something different than the agony that you felt every moment, every second of your life. And to make matters worse, this boat full of Jews that arrived would have seen him as utterly unclean, despised, and cursed. They wouldn't have just seen a man who was a lost cause, but most likely a person deserving what he was getting. You can almost imagine his life being a sort of a cautionary tale for mums and dads of what happens when you don't do what is right, or what it might be to be a Gentile. The whole situation is overwhelming. And I can't help but wonder what we would do if someone like this came to our house. I would love to think that we would treat that person differently. But my fear, beloved, is that we would easily treat them as this community had treated him. That we would see him as any Jew would have seen him, forsaken, cursed, and condemned. So what does the Son of God, who commands the winds and the waves, do when he gets off the boat? Read with me. When he saw Jesus from a distance, he ran and knelt down before him, and he cried out with a loud voice, "What do you have to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you before God, don't torment me." For he had told him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." "What is your name?" he asked him. "My name is Legion," he answered him, "because we are many." And he begged him earnestly not to send them out of the region. A large herd of pigs were there, feeding on the hillside. The demons begged him, "Jesus, send us to the pigs so that we may enter them." So he gave them permission, and the unclean spirits came out and entered the pigs. The herd of about 2,000 rushed down the steep bank into the sea and drowned there. The men who tended them ran off and reported it in the town and the countryside, and people went to see what had happened. I remember showing my kids just recently a movie I grew up with. It was just a classic movie, a movie that had captured my imagination, that was just, oh, just the best story. I won't tell you what it is, just in case you tease me. But what I was shocked was how often my kids were captured by the background. So I would get every question under the sun, like, Dad, why is that button in the background flashing? Dad, why are they wearing those clothes? Dad, why do they have funny names? They were so caught up with every other single detail that they missed the point of the movie. I was so frustrated. I was like, Bud, just watch it. Just like, don't worry about that stuff. Just look at the movie. And I can feel that this can be the case here. We are so caught up with very confronting details that we miss the point of the passage. This is one of these unique moments where we have a more in-depth interaction between Jesus and demons. The stuff of Hollywood, right? Makeup, myth, makeup stuff. And because of this, I need to clarify some stuff. Firstly, the scene that we find ourselves in as Jesus lands and a man confronts him isn't to give us the ins and outs of demon possession. Can I say that again? The point of this story isn't to give us a sort of ins and outs of demon possession. If you were to build a whole theological premise or a practice of demon possession on this passage, you've done Christ and this passage an injustice. That is not the point of the story. The point of these details, like the details my kids observed in the movie, were meant to serve a larger point. They were pointing to something else. And I'm going to say that the point of this passage is actually to show us who Jesus is, and more specifically, who he is in contrast to the community, his disciples, and the demons. Mark is trying to show the listeners, the readers, who Jesus is. This isn't a time to go, oh, so, you know, this is how demons work. We don't get enough detail to work that out. So if you're going to ask that question, ask away. I just probably won't be able to help you. And it's not the point of this passage. The second thing I need you to notice, and I need to clarify, is that the clash we have between God and the kingdom of darkness, Jesus and demons, isn't a clash of yin and yang, that somehow evil and good are on the equal footing. Like they're equally matched. That somehow God is fighting, you know, the darkness of this world, and let's hope he might just win. That is not the case. There is one kingdom that truly rules, and there's one that pretends to. We need to grasp that when Jesus approaches darkness, evil, there is no yin and yang equal footing. Notice what the demon does when it approaches Jesus. He kneels before him and acknowledges before everyone, Jesus is Son of the Most High God. There is no comparison here for the demon, neither in power or strength or status. It understands with clarity that Jesus is superior in every single way. And as hell-bent and as evil as demons are, they are never, ever deluded to think that they can compare to the true King. What does that say about us? Now, this is the strikingly obvious reality that they, demons, face when they come before Jesus, that they are utterly at his mercy. And it's not the other way around. Beloved, the darkness trembles before our King. Wickedness cowers and evil cries out. There is one who is in control and there is one that is not. They're the two things I need you to grasp as we start to unpack this a bit more. Jesus, the Son of the Most High God, who isn't powerless or helpless in this situation, converses with evil in a way that no other being can. Where human beings would be overwhelmed or would cower in fear or would be overpowered by evil, Jesus isn't. He can interact with evil without being tainted or overpowered. He's not manipulated by it. He's not tricked by it. He sees clearly. And this conversation reveals that very, very clearly. Jesus asked the man, "What is your name?" Or the demon, if you like. Now, I say this often, but I'll keep saying it. When God asks a question, it isn't because he doesn't know the answer. So when you read your Bible and when Jesus asks his disciples or anyone else a question, you've got to understand it's not that Jesus doesn't know the answer. He only ever asks a question to draw our attention to an important detail or truth. So he asked the demon, didn't have to. He could have just said go and it would have obeyed. But he asks in front of his disciple and in front of other people from that community who have come to observe Jesus what his name is. And the demon answers, "My name is Legion, because we are many." What possessed this man wasn't just one demon, but a legion. Now look, for those historical buffs, back then, a legion was a Roman sort of cohort that consisted of close to 6,000 foot soldiers, 120 horsemen. So most people knew that when you said a legion, it meant a lot of people. In other words, Jesus reveals that this man had suffered not just at the hands of one unclean spirit, but an extraordinary amount of them. This man is as lost and as broken and as damaged and as possessed as you can be. It's almost ridiculous how broken this bloke is. You'd almost think, well, what hope does he have? Yet notice what comes next. The demon begs and Jesus gives permission. Notice the posture. The demon has to beg Jesus to do anything at this point. The Lord of Lords and the King of Kings shows mercy when he had no prerogative to. Yet this is intentional. He does something that I don't think anyone was sort of thinking he would do. Often when you see his interaction with demons up until this point, he says leave and they leave without any hint of return. And yet at this point, he does something intentional. And it's here where things get a little tricky, as many have different opinions as to why Jesus allows them to come out of the man and into pigs. I'm going to argue that Jesus is drawing out an important contrast here. The pigs become a live parable, if you like. The demons who are bent on destroying all that God had made good, bent on causing as much suffering, pain, and despair in humanity, is about to be revealed for who they are. These demons only wanted to kill, only to wring out every ounce of life from those that they possessed. And so the pigs become an illustration. The pigs being possessed by these demons rush headlong to the sea where they are drowned and killed, destroyed. This is what demons have to offer, death and destruction. But notice what sits in contrast. Notice what the King of Kings has to offer instead. Where demons offer death, destruction, pain, Jesus offers something so much better. Because after casting out these demons, the man who had been possessed, who had no hope, who had nothing left but pain and agony, this man who was forsaken, cursed, and condemned, is now restored, forgiven, redeemed, set free. The contrast cannot be more stark. Where the demons and their kingdom offer lies, oppression and death. Our King offers life and restoration. Where our King commands the winds and the waves, these demons offer nothing but utter agony. Jesus shows more vividly something more breathtaking than the commandment, though, of winds and waves. Right here in this scene, where the disciples go, "Who is this bloke that can speak and creation listens?" does what no one else can do. He commands evil and it flees. He heals and saves the unsavable and the uncurable. Jesus transforms human lives like no other person can. Where humans try to control and have power, Jesus has all of that. And so read with me with what he does. They came to Jesus, that's the townspeople, and saw the man who had been demon-possessed sitting there, dressed in his right mind, and they were afraid. Those who had seen it described it to them what had happened to the demon-possessed man and told them about the pigs. Then they began to beg him to leave their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed begged him earnestly that he remain with him. Jesus did not let him, but told him, "Go home to your own people and report to them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." So he, the demon-possessed man, went out and began to proclaim in the Decapolis how much Jesus has done for him. And they were all amazed. Unfortunately, the illustration that the townspeople see that Jesus does with not only restoring this broken man, but showing what these demons have to offer, doesn't cause them to cheer or rejoice, but to fear and reject. It causes them to plead with Jesus to leave, because I think they can't imagine life with a more powerful being. They are just as blinded as that demon-possessed man had been. I can't imagine what a higher being who had more power could provide, because all they had tasted was human brokenness and demon possession. And so they ask the one who had freed and restored, healed and transformed to leave. The giver of life was asked to get out. But again, Jesus does what no one expects him to do, and he still has incredible mercy on people who are undeserving of his love. The man who is now healed begs to come to Jesus, but instead, Jesus says no and gives him a new purpose, a new joy, a new life. He tells the former demon-possessed man, "Go home to your own people and report to them how much the Lord has done for you and how he has had mercy on you." Jesus says, go to the people who had cast you out, who had rejected you, who had tried to sort of imprison you, who had left you for dead. Tell them that you've found something infinitely better. Tell them about me, Jesus. Tell this people all that I have done, and offer them something that they never offered you. That Jesus can save anyone. Beloved, we sometimes think we need something, some sort of grander purpose, some gift or recognition, when every redeemed son and daughter of God has the greatest gift and purpose you will ever have. You get to tell people what Jesus has done in your life, what he means to you. That's not small. That is life-changing, breathtaking, cosmic stuff. That the God of all creation would change you. You don't need to be a well-standing preacher to do that. You don't need to be academically brilliant to sort of reason it out. There's a reason we run the life course, so that you may be better equipped to know that you, all of you, have the capacity to share with every single one out there what who Jesus is and what he's done for you. This demon-possessed man who had nothing for him now has everything going for him. And if you know how the gospel spreads, once Jesus ascends, you will start to realize that his work did not go unnoticed. The Decapolis becomes a city that does, in different towns and cities, receive the gospel in powerful ways. But I guess the question needs to be asked, in one sense, how do we have access to what Jesus offers? If this is what he does to the unsavable, the broken, the outcast, the most despicable person you can imagine, how do we receive what Jesus has to offer? Well, read with me. When Jesus had crossed over again after being sent out by boat to the other side, a large crowd had gathered around him. And while he was there by the sea, one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus, came and went to Jesus. He fell at his feet and begged him earnestly, "My little daughter is dying. Come and lay your hands on her so that she can get well and live." So Jesus went with him, and a large crowd was following and pressing against him. Now, a woman suffering from bleeding for 12 years had endured much under many doctors. She had spent everything she had and was not helped at all. On the contrary, she became worse. Now, Jesus, after crossing back, is confronted with two cases. The first of a synagogue leader pleading for his daughter's life. She's dying. And the second of another daughter who has suffered for a long time. Actually, as long as this little girl has been alive, she has suffered with an illness that has no cure, a constant bleeding. Both these cases present two impossibilities. First, a rescue from death, which no human has been able to do. And the second, a healing of an incurable disease. Let us deal with the second case first, as the narrative goes. But this woman, as Jesus heads to the house of Jairus, the woman who had been bleeding for 12 years, this is more than just an inconvenient illness. This is more than just having something that just annoyed you for a little while. First off, in Jewish society, the flow of blood meant to be unclean. And to be unclean in their society meant to be removed, just like the demon-possessed bloke. It meant to be ostracized. It meant to be out of deep community. Because you can only come back into community when you're clean. So this woman for 12 years has probably experienced nothing short of just lack of connection. It's been COVID 1.0, like to an extreme. But more than that, this woman, this daughter, has endured all sorts of pain, all sorts of examination from many doctors. So imagine that for a moment, that you've spent your whole livelihood trying to find a cure. And not only that, but you go from doctor to doctor, exposing yourself to them, trying to find a cure. But what happens is they have no prognosis, they have no cure, so all they offer you is a helplessness, a hopelessness. And what we read is that her pain is increased or is made worse every time she visits them. Imagine for a moment the mental and emotional strain coupled with the physical hurt. Imagine how despaired you'd feel to have your life for 12 years in agony, in pain, in shame, in a sort of state of forsakenness, just how broken, hopeless you would feel. Imagine for a moment the desperation, that you just want this to be taken away. You just want things to be better. And then I want you to imagine one day you're in the local marketplace and you start to hear the banter or the sort of gossip go around, that there's a guy going around healing every illness and disease. Imagine how that flame in your heart sort of flickers. You dare to hope, yet you're fearful of the result. The doctors couldn't heal, but apparently this guy can. And you imagine for a moment the news too good to be true, because you go, no, I've been disappointed time and time again by doctor after doctor. But at the same time, you have nothing to lose. And so you investigate. And the more you find out about this man, the more the evidence confronts you. As you start to talk to those who were impaired, who were sick, who had incurable diseases, and who are now fully healed and fully restored, transformed, in fact. Imagine what this woman would have felt that as the news of Jesus spread, she just heard he'd come to her town. Imagine what you would do if you'd heard that he had arrived. Read with me. Having heard about Jesus, she came up behind him in the crowd and touched his clothing. For she said, "If I just touch his clothes, I'll be made well." Instantly, her flow of blood ceased, and she sensed in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Immediately, Jesus realized that power had gone out of him. He turned around in the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" His disciples said to him, "You see the crowd pressing against you, yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" But he was looking around to see who had done this. The woman, with fear and trembling, knowing what had happened to her, came and fell down before him and told him the whole truth. "Daughter," he said to her, "your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be healed from your affliction." Now, much like the story of the demon-possessed man, it would be easy to think that the point of these stories is the actual healings, but it isn't. Can I say that again? The point of these stories aren't the healings. If you overemphasize the healings over what Jesus is trying to show us, you'll miss it and you'll jumble it all together. I'm going to argue that the healings in this case, just like the demon-possessed man, all point to something. They merely provide evidence of something more beautiful and more sweeter. Let me show you what I mean. The woman determined to meet or even touch Jesus thinks to herself, "If I just touch his clothes, I'll be made well." Now, let me pause here for a moment. Something has shifted for her. She has tried everything with the doctors and it's failed. It's actually, things have gotten worse every time she's tried. News about Jesus has been spreading and she's either investigated or she's finally been convinced, but she's reached a point where she thinks, she believes that if I just touch Jesus' clothes, I will be healed. Something has shifted in her heart and mind about who Jesus is. And so in the midst of the moving crowd, she navigates them as they move to the house of the dying daughter. And she finally finds her opening and she touches his robe, just touches it. And immediately, straight away, relief, healing. And what does Jesus do? He stops the crowd. They're walking fast, most likely, to get to this dying daughter, and he stops. And he asks the whole crowd, who are pressing in against him, "Who touched my clothes?" I love that his disciples, because they're so like they state the obvious because they never get what Jesus is on about, which just brings so much hope to me. Because so often I'm like, "God, I don't know what you're doing," but I love that he still humours us. But just quickly remember, God, Jesus, never asks questions that he doesn't know the answer to. So there's a reason to this. He stops. Disciples are mystified. They're like, "Well, Jesus, look, crowd." But ignoring them, he just keeps looking into the crowd. "Who touched my clothes?" And then finally this woman, who is trembling. Imagine how scared she would be. She steps out of the crowd And she tells Jesus the whole truth. I mean, she could have slipped out. There was a massive crowd. She could have just gone, okay, I'm just going to slowly make my way out. He's obviously looking for me. So if he's looking for me, he probably hasn't noticed me. She could have made a break for it and gone to the safety of home. And yet, she doesn't. She stops, walks forward, falls at Jesus' feet, and tells him everything. Now, Jesus, by this point, has been healing hundreds, if not thousands, and yet decides to make a point. Why? Why not let this poor woman go? I mean, why embarrass her? Why make her stand in front of a crowd of thousands? Because he's trying to show this precious daughter something infinitely precious. Listen again to what he says to her when she finally steps forward. Daughter, your faith has saved you. Go in peace and be healed from your affliction. He calls her daughter. This woman would have, like most people, even her parents probably wouldn't have liked to have called her daughter because of the shame of being unclean. And yet in this moment, in front of everyone, Jesus restores her belonging. But to who? Who does he restore her belonging to? No one other than the true God who calls his people sons and daughter, the God Most High. He says in front of everyone, this woman is God's daughter. And everyone is listening and watching. Jesus has restored her to her true father. Imagine what those words would have meant to her when every person in that crowd would have thought of her as cursed. That she now has the title, the intimate title of daughter. In other words, in God's eyes, she's mine. But more than that, listen to what Jesus says next to her. Your faith has saved you. Her faith, her trust in Jesus has saved her. But from what? Because let me clarify that he's not talking about that, oh, your faith has saved you from your social status. Your faith has saved you from a physical impairment. That's what he means. So your faith has saved you. You're no longer bleeding. You're no longer in agony. And look, you're now accepted by the community. That's not what he says, because the next thing he says is, go in peace, you've been healed from your affliction. So there's a contrast he's drawing. She now has peace with the community. He has healed her. He makes a point of that. So what does he mean when he says, daughter, your faith has saved you? Well, she was saved from what matters most in this life. She was saved from that kingdom of darkness, that enslavement where her sins had captured her, had brought her to the conclusion of, that had breathed the consequence of death, judgment, and condemnation. Her faith in Jesus brought more than physical healing. It brought her true healing. She was now forgiven, spotless and pure, a daughter of God made righteous and holy before his sight. How? By faith, by her trust in the King, the Christ. Her trust in Jesus, that's all she brought to the table. And look what Jesus says it brings. Restored relationship with the God of the universe. Your sins, your brokenness, your evil, your everything, your shame, your hurt, your guilt, all of it washed away. How? By trusting in the one who commands winds and waves. By trusting in the one who heals even the most broken and utterly despised of people. Her faith had saved her. Her faith had brought her from death to life. That is all we bring, beloved friends. Jesus offers you life, and all he asks is trust the gift that he's offering. I'm not selling you anything. I'm not promising you easy sailing, but I am promising you a relationship that will transform everything you know. Everything. I'm telling you to trust in the one who brings from death life. Read with me. While they were still speaking, people came from the synagogue's leader's house and said, "Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher anymore? Teach." When Jesus overheard what was said, he told the synagogue leader, "Don't be afraid. Only believe. Only have faith. Only trust. He, Jesus, did not let anyone accompany him except Peter, James, and John," James's brother. "They came to the leader's house and he saw a commotion, people weeping and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, 'Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead but asleep.' They laughed at him, but he put them all outside. He took the child's father, mother, and those who were with him and entered the place where the child was. Then he took the child by the hand and said to her, 'Talitha kum,' which is translated, 'Little girl, I say to you, get up.' Immediately, the girl got up and began to walk. She was 12 years old. At this, they were utterly astounded. Then he gave them the strict orders that no one should know about this and told them to give her something to eat. I recently spoke to my parents about the death of their son, my brother Joe. And I guess filled in details that I never had before. My brother, about a week before his birth, his umbilical cord wrapped around his neck and he died stillborn. I can't speak with experience what it is to lose the life of a child. But I do remember the scenes of what it was like for my parents. I remember the tears and the grief. I saw clearly how the anguish sort of was always there, the despair. I used to remember listening to them cry quietly in their room when they thought no one was listening. Look, and I still, like, even the funeral, for me, it's a blur because I couldn't handle the agony of losing a brother, so what little minds usually do is just block it out. I can remember every detail, but the actual funeral is just blank in my head. There is a lot that as I was talking to my parents and hearing their anguish, hearing their pain, I noticed there's not much more devastating than this. The death of a beloved son, or child, sorry. So I want you for a moment, like, I know it's really easy to read this narrative and go, oh, his daughter died and then Jesus made it better. But this is real. This happened. I want you to imagine for a moment how Jairus would have felt as he traveled back with Jesus. Imagine for a moment as you're traveling with the crowd, you see your house on the horizon and hope in your heart as you know Jesus is by your side. And then you hear the noise. Something's not right. And someone approaches you. Your daughter is dead. Imagine for a moment as your vision begins to blur, the noises begin to finally echo and you start to recognize what you're hearing. It's wailing. It's grief. It's crying. I think he struggled to breathe, struggled to speak, he struggled to see. Imagine how quickly that sorrow pulls you down. Down in that sort of darkness, hopelessness, that numbness. And then suddenly, as though a window cracks in your grief and you start to see light seep in, you hear a voice speak. Why are you making a commotion and weeping? The child is not dead but asleep. Jesus then grabs your hand and the hand of your wife and leads you inside. And then as you enter the room, you see your daughter. You see the unavoidable reality of death, that all-conquering king, that unwanted intruder, that testimony that something is wrong with humanity. And yet, in the face of death, you hear a voice whisper that makes even death tremble. Talitha kum. Little girl, I say to you, get up. And in the power of these words, life bursts forth from that little girl that lay dead. And she begins to walk. This 12-year-old girl who had tasted death now tastes life. The hope my parents had, if you don't know them, and still have to this day, isn't that believing in Jesus, you're avoided of all tragedies. The point of these stories aren't to say that you follow Jesus and none of your children will die. That is not the point of the narrative. The point of all these stories is to point you to the one who speaks life into death and it happens. The hope my parents have to this day is that in trusting in Jesus, those tragedies do not win. That death does not have the final say. That there is one we can hope in even in the darkest of days. Even when everything fails. Even when you have nothing left, beloved. You have one who holds you in his hands and you are his son or daughter. Even when the whole world forsakes you, you have one who will not. Even if you have an illness or a sickness that causes you grief and pain every second of every day, and I know, beloved, there are some of you who feel the sting of that, some of you who I love dearly who go through that. Can I ask you, can I remind you, to trust in the one who is mightier than even death itself. Because God will one day, in this narrative, sorry, he has already, give up his one and only beloved son so that we would never have to taste death as it was fully intended. Let me pray.